Spellbound by Beauty, Alfred Hitchcock and His Leading Ladies, published by Hutchinson in London. And the other is Alfred Hitchcock, A Life in Darkness and Light by Patrick McGilligan, For the Defense, published by HarperCollins. Whichever side you fall on, each side of the case is treated with a lot of detail, and that will just leave, which will leave it up to the reader to make up their mind.
The book we're looking at today is a monograph on Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt by Diane Negra, with Matthew of Cabo's Gremlin Time and Professor Lisa Neville of Cortland University in New York State. And we will be back next week with another Film at 11.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a web and new media coordinator. Our web and new media coordinator is responsible for KBOO's website and social media accounts. Applicants should have experience administering a CMS such as Drupal and experience administering a MySQL database, including backups and queries. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment. Applications are due by November 17th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week, we present a newly found recording of the extraordinary writer, poet, and activist, Audre Lorde.
You know, one of the terrible things, I think, about the kind of consumption, or the kind of consumptive life or consumptive society that we live in, is that one of the first things it consumes is our history. And so over and over again, those things that would allow us to make coalitions, to make connections between the things that have happened to us, the things that have happened to our mothers, to our fathers, to people before us, are lost. And as I say elsewhere, we're constantly being put in the position of having to reinvent the wheel.
Our recording is from November 1980. Here's the host of the WBAI series, The Velvet Sledgehammer, to introduce the evening with poet Audre Lorde.
Good afternoon and welcome to The Velvet Sledgehammer, the radio magazine of the Women's Department of WBAI. Today, we have a very, very special program. First, tapes of a poetry and prose reading, An Evening with Audre Lorde. On December 12, 1980, prize-winning poet and writer Audre Lorde gave a reading of her poetry and her prose. The reading was a benefit for the Women's Experimental Theater, and it was a gala and well-attended event. Audre Lorde talked and read from her poetry and from her inspiring new book, Cancer Journal. Claire Koss, who introduced Audre Lorde.
I'm pleased and privileged to be introducing Audre Lorde to this benefit reading for the Women's Experimental Theater tonight. It's wonderful to see all of you here. I remember about 5 years ago, the first time you came to a performance of Daughters, after which we invited the audience to stay and form a circle to name their matrilineage together. You said, I am Audrey, daughter of Linda, daughter of Ma Liz, daughter of a woman who lived on Knowles Hill, daughter of Sebelisa, the mother of us all. Audrey had been to visit Dahomey with her lover and son and daughter, and was immersed in her research on African mythologies and goddesses, making accessible in her poems such names and concepts as Mawalisa, the sky goddess god, Yemanja, the mother of Orisha and goddess of oceans, Sebelisa, the mother of us all, and many others. In the black unicorn, these gods and goddesses of Dahomey and Nigeria cross paths with and connect with Staten Island and 125th Street, find refuge in poems of loving, and tear through violent images of black children being shot down and murdered by white policemen. To name all of Audre Lorde's accomplishments would take the entire evening, and also the honors that she's received. But my favorite introduction is Audre's own words in a recent essay where she says, "I am black, lesbian, feminist, poet, mother of a daughter and son, and member of an interracial couple." She essentially goes on to say, "How many things can our society hate me for?" Audre lives on the front lines. She lives openly and charts forbidden and unknown terrains, and she empowers us with her courage. Her most recent battle with breast cancer, the terror, the pain, and the daily triumph, has become an impassioned and valued resource for women in the cancer journals, just published by Spinsters, Inc. Audre Lorde is an Amazon warrior who challenges each one of us by her choice to break silences, to survive, and to celebrate life. Audre Lorde.
I would like to open the reading with a poem that I feel is very timely, or that occurred to me, because it seems to say, for me, something that I need to be reminded of, and something that I think that most of us do, particularly in this time when I think we all feel so much under siege for one reason or the other. And the title of this poem is A Song for Many Movements. Nobody wants to die on the way, caught between ghosts of whiteness and the real water. None of us wanted to leave our bones on the way to salvation. Three planets to the left a century of light years ago. Our spices were separate and particular, but our skins sing in complementary keys. At a quarter to eight meantime, we were telling the same stories over and over and over. But broken down gods survive in the crevasses and mud pots of every beleaguered city, where it is obvious there are too many bodies to cast to the ovens or gallows, and our uses have become more important than our silence. After the fall, too many empty cases of blood to bury or burn, and there will be nobody left to listen. And our labor has become more important than our silence. Our labor is more important than our silence. I really love to read prayers. I love to read prayers for strength in particular. And this is one of newer one, and the title of it is October. Spirits of the abnormally born live on in water, and the heroically dead in the entrails of snake. I spend my days now like a wild bridge swaying in place, caught between poems like a vice. I am finishing my piece of this bargain. And how shall I return? Sebolisa, mother of power, keeper of birds, fat and beautiful, give me the strength in your eyes to remember what I have learned. Help me to attend with passion these tasks at my hands for doing. Carry my needs to some shore that my feet will not shatter. Do not let me pass away before I have a name for this tree under which I am lying. Do not let me die still needing to be stranger. You know, one of the terrible things, I think, about the kind of consumption, or the kind of consumptive life or consumptive society that we live in, is that one of the first things it consumes is our history.
And so over and over again, those things that would allow us to make coalitions, to make connections between the things that have happened to us, the things that have happened to our mothers, to our fathers, to people before us, are lost. And as I say elsewhere, we're constantly being put in the position of having to reinvent the wheel or reinvent the psychic wheel. The ways in which, though, the impressions, the ways in which the images that fall into our heads, whether or not we recall them in terms of history, the ways in which those things operate, short circuit so many of the other things that we see, short circuit so many of our emotions, is a question that haunts me over and over, and I'm so aware of it within my life and within my living. And this next poem, which is a new poem, is called After Images, because it deals with some of the ways in which the pictures which we eat all the time cross us up, and the ways in which sometimes they both fuel our fight and put it out. After Images. Rock-strewn caves where dragonfish evolve, wild for life, relentlessly acquisitive, learning to survive where there is no food. My eyes are always hungry and remembering. However the image enters, its force remains. A white woman stands bereft and empty. A black boy hacked into a murderous lesson, recalled in me forever, like a lurch of earth on the edge of sleep. Unknown faces etched into my visions like food for dragonfish who learn to live upon what they must eat. Fused sorrows born together, the bloody images beneath my pain. Part 2. I watch the evening news. The Pearl River floods through the streets of Jackson, a Mississippi summer televised. Trapped houses kneel like sinners in the rain, while a white woman climbs from her roof into a passing boat. She is tearless, no longer young, a child's green blanket tucked beneath her arm. In the flickering after images of a nightmare rain, the microphone is the evening sacrament of connection thrust up against her flat, bewildered words. We just come from the bank yesterday, borrowing money to pay the income tax. Now everything is gone. I never knew it could be so hard. Despair weighs down her voice like Pearl River mud. Her pale eyes scan the camera for help or explanation. Unanswered, she looks across the watered street, dry-eyed. Hard, but not this hard. Two tow-headed children hang upon her coat like mirrors, until a man with ham-like hands snarls her aside. She ain't got nothing more to say. And that lie hangs in his mouth like a shred of rotting meat. Part 3. I inherited Jackson, Mississippi. For my majority, it gave me Emmett Till, his 15 years puffed out like bruises on plump boy cheeks, his first and last Mississippi summer. Whistling a 21-gun salute to Dixie while a white girl passed him in the street. And he was baptized my son forever in the bloody waters of the Midnight Pearl, his broken body the after image of my 21st year. Walking steamy streets of a northern city, my eyes averted from each corner's grim photographies, newspapers, protest posters, magazines, police story confidential, true, the avid persistence of detail, pretending insight or some new information, the length of gash across the dead boy's loins, what his mother said, the severed lips, how many burns, his gouged out eyes sewed shut upon the screaming covers, louder than life. Everywhere, the veiled warning, the secret relish of a black child's mutilated body, fingered by street corner eyes, bruise upon livid bruise. And wherever I looked that summer, I learned to be at home with children's blood, with relished violence, with horror etched into my eyes like flame, with pictures of young, broken flesh, used and crumpled and discarded, lying in the sidewalk refuse like a raped woman's face. A 15-year-old black boy from Chicago whistled on the streets of Jackson, testing what he'd been taught was a manly thing to do. His teachers ripped out his eyes, his sex, his tongue, his future, and flung him, beaten to the pearl, weighted with stone, in the name of white womanhood. They took
This is a coordinated monthly test of the emergency alert system through broadcast stations in the greater Portland-Vancouver area, including Clackamas, Columbia, Multnomah, and Washington counties in Oregon, and Clark County in Washington, with the cooperation of public safety broadcasters and cable operators. This system informs you of events that pose an immediate threat to your life, health, or property. If this had been an actual emergency, official information would have followed the alert tone. This test was originated by Clackamas County in Oregon. This concludes this test message.
Hard, but not this hard. Her face is flattened with resignation and despair. A white woman surveying her crumpled future as the white girl defiled by Emmett's whistle, never named. She stands adrift in the ruins of her honor, and a white man with a hatchet face pulls her away with a snarl. Within my eyes, the flickering afterimage of a nightmare rain. A woman wrings her hands beneath the weight of agonies remembered. I wade through blood, betrayed by vision, hers and my own, becoming dragonfish to survive the horrors we are living with, tortured lungs adapting to breathe blood. The woman surveys her life's damage. My dreams are ripped with bayonets of fire. My eyes are caves, etched rock, tied to the ghost of a black boy whistling, crying, frightened. Her tow-headed children cluster like little mirrors of despair, and soundlessly a woman begins to weep. I'm an early riser, very early, as some of you may know, and it's always really difficult to find people to communicate with at 5:30. 6 o'clock in the morning. But it's always very rewarding when I do. It always makes me wonder, though, what we're supposed to do, those of us who rise early and are full of light and various and assorted other kinds of gifts at that time. The title of this poem is Morning is a Time for Miracles. A core of the conversations we never had lies in the distance between your wants and mine, a piece of each buried behind the wall which separates our sameness, a talisman of birth hidden at the root of your mother's spirit, my mother's fury. Now, reaching for you with my sad words between sleeping and waking, a runic stone speaks. What is asked for is destroyed by the very words that must seek it, like dew in the early morning, dissolving the tongue of salt as well as its thirst. and I call you secret names of praise and fire that sound like your birthright, but are not the names of a friend. While you hide from me under 100 excuses, lying like tombstones along the road between your house and mine. I could accept any blame I understood, but picking over the fresh and possible loneliness of this too early morning, I find the relics of history fossilized into a prison where I learn to make love forever better than how to make friends, where you are encased like a half-stoned peach in the rigid arts of your healing. And in case you have ever tried to reach me and I could not hear you, these words are in place of the dead air still between us. A memorial to the conversations we will not be having, to laughter shared and important as the selves we helped make real, but also to the dead revelations we bury stillborn in the refuse of fear and silence and your remembered eyes which don't meet mine anymore. I never intended to let you slip through my fingers, nor to ever purchase your interest again like the desire of a whore who yawns behind her upturned hand, pretending a sigh of pleasure, and I have had that too already. Once I thought when I opened my eyes we would move into a freer, more open country where the sun would illuminate all our different desires and the fresh air do us honor for who we were. Yet I have awakened at 4 a.m. with a ribald joke to tell you and found I had lost the name of the street where you hid under an assumed name. And I knew I would have to bleed again in order to find you. But just once in the possibilities of this too early morning, I wanted you to talk, not as a healer, but as a lonely woman talking to a friend. I guess if I had a collection of poems charted through all of my books or all of my different stages, poems to my mother, they would be a particular journey, a very specific journey, because they go through change after change after change. And this is the latest one. And the title of it is In the Voice of My Departing Mother. My mother is blind. Yours is the first face of love I remember. But I belong to myself in the rude places, in the glare of your angriest looks. In my dream, your blood runs like angry red water. Your blood running through my dreams like red angry water. And whomever I kill turns in the death grasp into your last and most beautiful silence. In this white room full of strangers, I examine your blind hazel eyes for that old and frightening blue that marks the sea queen's warrior daughters. Once I sought you in 100 different faces. Now I see you as my own, grown beautiful and grave, who was always blinding in that treacherous light that obscures what it dares not illuminate, a bond of women beyond birth or blood. I search your face, unafraid of those fierce eyes that can no longer see, yet still long in their scrutiny for a me that never was. Before I go, I touch your hand with tenderness, remembering not the denials that I have survived, but the gifts still puzzling me. As in the voice of my departing mother, antique and querulous, flashes of your old toughness shine through like stars, teaching me how to die insisting death is not a disease. The last poem I'm going to read is, interestingly enough, also a new poem. And it's unfinished in that the title of it is Outline About Us. It's a poem which is dedicated to my lover, Francis. And it's called Outline About Us, really, because every time I think of it, it feels like the table of contents for a book, right? A few volumes. Outline About Us. What hue lies in the slit of anger, ample and pure as night? What color the channel that blood comes through? A black woman and a white woman charter our courses close in this sea of calculated distance, warned away by reefs of hidden angers, of history rallied against us, rigid with well-earned caution, the remembered smell of blood, mistrust, betrayal, misnamed alliances cheaply bought, maintained at terrible price. And we reject unspoken decisions not to touch or see the agonies that lay between us. Rage, guilt, fear, love, as complicated as a hurricane, each with threads to be unwound, but not easily. We cannot conquer history by ignoring it. So much has been eradicated that would tell us we were not the first black woman, white woman, altering course to fit our own journeys in this treacherous sea. Even the act of turning is almost fatally difficult. Coming around full face into the driving storm, putting an end to running before the wind. A black woman and a white woman in the open fact of our loving, with not only our enemies' hands raised against us, means a gradual sacrifice of all that is simple, of pretense, of separate solutions, of convenient avoidance, putting an end to running before the wind, my blackness, her whiteness, a new meeting in a world that has never been ours. We reached out to touch the other face across an ocean of deceits, deep and calcite jagged, ready to engulf us, and that was nothing compared to reaching out to touch each other's days. The images of hate would threaten each lover's quarrel, guilt, contamination of feeling, knife in the schoolyard, revenge, the unattainable conquered, gob of spit on my sleeve in our childhood street. Yet both our mothers scrubbed the kitchens of houses where comfortable women died a separate silence. And all the earned power of difference deflected into the unexamined safety of hatred, of suspicion, of contempt in the service of a dying order while we were taught to understand and tolerate only the strangenesses of men. A black woman and a white woman, lovers, are already embattled by choice. When women make love beyond the first exploration, we meet each other's knowledge in a landscape the rest of our lives attempts to understand. The power of tenderness, after the first commitment, how many more recurrent, knowing the hardest is only the first, how to do what we need for our living with honor and in love, Now we move through each other's strangenesses with a half-remembered sureness, eye to eye, unchartered, terrified, full of promise. Two women carving our own agendas with lightning, examining every cell of the past for what is useful. We have never been younger. Reconstructing a future we can fuel from our knowledge, which no woman fears because she is woman. A cross is burning 10 blocks away before a house where black and white people are living. We are a black woman and a white woman with our 2 black children. We reach for a future we can both empower, because there is no other possible choice for our tomorrows as fruitful. 1 black woman, 1 white woman, constructing a way towards some new definition in the name of love and survival.
You are listening to a rare recording of poet Audre Lorde on From the Vault. For more information or to get a copy of the complete program or any other program in our series, visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or call us toll-free in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. You can research our collection at pacificaradioarchives.org. We invite you to be part of a new broadcast on September 11th, 2011. The Pacific Network is presenting an 8-hour special broadcast, 9/11's Footprint on America, a Decade Later, and the Pacifica Archives will be part of that broadcast. We invite you to be part of that broadcast by calling us in the archives and leaving a message, a thought. 1-800-735-0230 is the number to call, and you can leave your message on extension 264. You can also go to facebook.com and look for Friends of the Pacifica Radio Archives group and leave us a message there, and we will also translate that for the program. And now to the beautiful poetry and prose of Ms. Audre Lorde.
I'd like to read some excerpts now from the Cancer Journals, which is a collection of prose. Let me tell you a little bit about how it came to be written. How it came to be written was, I have breast cancer, and after my mastectomy, I decided that while I was going through it and before I was making my decision, I looked for words, for other women's words that would give me a sense, not of what to do, but of another woman's experience. And I could not find them. I found books written by women that dealt with certain aspects, but not from the core. And certainly not any words from feminists, certainly no words from black feminists, and certainly no words from black lesbians. And I decided that it was about time, right? Some of it got aired. And also because it helped me. The book is really a collection. There are 3 essays and an introduction. And I would like to read a piece from the introduction and some from the last essay. Each woman responds to the crisis that breast cancer brings to her life out of a whole pattern, which is the design of who she is and how her life has been lived. The weave of her everyday existence is the training ground for how she handles crisis. I am a post-mastectomy woman who believes our feelings need voice in order to be recognized, respected, and of use. I do not wish my anger and pain and fear about cancer to fossilize into yet another silence, nor to rob me of whatever strength can lie at the core of this experience, openly acknowledged and examined. For other women of all ages, colors, and sexual identities who recognize that imposed silence about any area of our lives is a tool for separation and powerlessness, and for myself, I have tried to voice some of my feelings and thoughts about the travesty of prosthesis, the pain of amputation, the function of cancer in a profit economy, my confrontation with mortality, the strength of women loving and the power and rewards of self-conscious living. Breast cancer and mastectomy are not unique experiences. They are ones shared by thousands of American women. Each of these women has a particular voice to be raised in what must become a female outcry against all preventable cancers, as well as against the secret fears that allow those cancers to flourish. May these words serve as encouragement for other women to speak and to act out of our experiences with cancer and with other threats of death. For silence has never bought us anything of worth. Most of all, may these words underline the possibilities of self-healing and the richness of living for all women. Now, there is a commonality of isolation and painful reassessment that is shared by all women with breast cancer, whether this commonality is recognized or not. It is not my intention to judge the woman who has chosen the path of prosthesis. Do you all know what I'm speaking of when I speak of prosthesis? Do you know what a prosthesis is? No. Prosthesis is a false breast. It's a falsy. And this is given to women right after breast cancer. You're supposed to wear it and pretend that nothing has ever happened, right? Supposed to be that we are supposedly, what we're told is that we are as good as before. And this is absolutely accepted. Probably most women who've had mastectomies wear these things. It is not my intention to judge the woman who has chosen the path of prosthesis, of silence and invisibility, the woman who wishes to be, quote, the same as before. She has survived on another kind of courage, and she is not alone. Each of us struggles daily with the pressures of conformity, the loneliness of difference from which those choices seem to offer escape. I only know that these choices do not work for me, nor for other women who, not without fear, have survived cancer by scrutinizing its meaning within our lives and by attempting to integrate that crisis into useful strengths for change. I have learned a great deal in the 18 months since my mastectomy. My visions of a future I can create have been honed by the lessons of my limitations. Now I wish to give form with honesty and precision to the pain, faith, labor, and loving which this period of my life has translated into strength for me. Sometimes fear stalks me like another malignancy, sapping energy and power and attention from my work. A cold becomes sinister, a cough, lung cancer, a bruise, leukemia. But those fears I have found are most powerful when I do not give them voice, because close upon their heels comes a fury that I cannot shake them. I am learning to live beyond fear by living through it, and in the process, trying to learn to turn fury at my own limitations into a more creative energy. I realize that if I wait until I am no longer afraid to act, write, speak, be, then I'll be sending little messages on a Ouija board, cryptic complaints from the other side. When I dare to be powerful, to use my strength in the service of vision, then it becomes less important whether or not I am unafraid. Because as women, we were all raised to fear. If I cannot banish fear completely, I can learn to count with it less. For then fear becomes not a tyrant against which I waste energy fighting, but a companion, not particularly desirable, but one whose knowledge can be useful. I write so much here about fear because in shaping this introduction to the cancer journals, I found fear laid across my hands like a steel bar. When I tried to examine the past 18 months, Some of what I touched was molten despair and waves of mourning. For my lost breast, for time, for the luxury of false power. Not only were these emotions difficult and painful to relive, but they were entwined with a terror that if I opened myself again to scrutiny, then I might also be opening myself to disease. But I had to remind myself that I had lived through it all already. I had known the pain, and I had survived. It only remained now for me to give it voice, to share it for use, that the pain not be wasted. Living a self-conscious life under the pressure of time, I work with the consciousness of death at my shoulder, not constantly, but often enough to leave a mark upon all of my life's decisions. And it does not matter whether this death comes next week or 30 years from now, this consciousness gives my life another breath. It helps shape the words I speak, the ways I love, my politic of action, the strength of my vision, my purpose, and the depth of my appreciation for living. I would lie if I did not speak of loss. Any amputation is a physical and psychic reality that must be integrated into a sense of self. The absence of my breast is a recurrent sadness, but it is not one that dominates my life. I miss it, sometimes piercingly. When other one-breasted women hide behind the mask of prosthesis, I find little support in the broader female environment for my rejection of what feels like a cosmetic sham. But I believe that socially sanctioned prosthesis is merely another way of keeping women with breast cancer silent and separate from each other. For instance, what would happen if an army of one-breasted women descended upon Congress and demanded that the use of carcinogenic fat-stored hormones in beef feed be outlawed? You get that picture? I have found that battling despair does not mean closing my eyes to the enormity of the tasks of effecting change. Nor does it mean ignoring the strength and the barbarity of the forces which are aligned against us. It means, however, teaching, surviving, and fighting with the most important resource I have, myself. And it means taking joy in that battle. It means for me recognizing the enemy outside and the enemy within, and knowing that my work is part of a continuum of women's work, of reclaiming this earth and our power, and knowing that this work did not begin with my birth, nor will it end with my death. It means knowing within that continuum, my life and my love and my work has particular power and meaning relative to others. It also means trout fishing on the Manisqua River at dawn and tasting the green silence and knowing that this beauty, too, is mine forever. Now, the second part of the Cancer Journals is retelling, actually, with excerpts from my journals of that time, of the experience of the days within the hospital and the period after. The third part of it is a long essay entitled Breast Cancer, Power Versus Prosthesis, and I would like to read a few excerpts from that. After a mastectomy, for many women, including myself, there is a feeling of wanting to go back, of not wanting to persevere through this experience to whatever enlightenment could be at the core of it. It is this feeling, this nostalgia, which is encouraged by most of the post-surgical counseling for women with breast cancer. This regressive tie to the past is emphasized by the concentration upon breast cancer as a cosmetic problem, one which can be solved by a prosthetic device. The American Cancer Society's Reach for Recovery program, while doing a valuable service in contacting women immediately after surgery, nonetheless encourages this false and dangerous nostalgia in the mistaken belief that women are too weak to deal directly and courageously with the realities of our lives. The woman for Reach for Recovery who came to see me in the hospital, while quite admirable and even impressive in her own right, certainly did not speak to my experience nor my concerns. As a 44-year-old black lesbian feminist, I knew there have been very few role models around for me in this situation. But my primary concern 2 days after mastectomy was hardly about what man I could capture in the future, whether or not my old boyfriend would still find me attractive, and also not whether my 2 children would be embarrassed by me around their friends, as if they are not embarrassed already. My concerns were about my chance for survival and the effect of a possibly shortened life upon my work and my priorities. Yet every attempt I made to examine or question the possibility or real integration of this into the totality of my life was ignored. Now, in the critical and vulnerable period following surgery, self-examination and self-evaluation are positive steps. To imply to a woman that she can be the same as before with the skillful application of a little puff of lamb's wool is to place an emphasis upon prosthesis, which encourages her not to deal with herself as physically and emotionally real. I am talking here about the need for every woman to live a considered life. The necessity for consideration grows and deepens as one faces directly one's own mortality and death. Self-scrutiny and an evaluation of our lives, while painful, can be rewarding and strengthening journeys toward a deeper self. For as we open ourselves more and more to the genuine conditions of our lives, women become less and less willing to tolerate those conditions unaltered, or to passively accept external and destructive controls over our lives and our identities. Any short-circuiting of this quest for self-definition keeps the post-mastectomy woman in a position of perpetual and secret insufficiency, infantilized and dependent for an identity upon an external definition by appearance. In this way, women are kept, once again, from experiencing or expressing the power of knowledge and experience, and through that expression, developing strengths that can challenge those structures within our lives that support the cancer establishment. Again, for instance, why hasn't the American Cancer Society publicized the connections between animal fat and breast cancer for our daughters, the way it has publicized the connection between cigarette smoking and lung cancer? These links between animal fat, hormone production, and breast cancer are not secret, and there are listings in the bibliography for those of you who wish to read more. This is a little incident that will perhaps illustrate to you the kinds of things we deal with. 10 days after having my breast removed, I went to my doctor's office to have the stitches taken out. This was my first journey since coming out of the hospital, and I was truly looking forward to it. Francis had washed my hair. It was black and shining with my new gray hairs, of which I am inordinately proud. I really am. That's why I don't wear a guilin. Glistening in the sun. Color was starting to come back into my face and around my eyes. I wore the most opalescent of my moonstones and a single floating bird dangling from my right ear in the name of grand asymmetry. With an African kente cloth tunic and new leather boots, I knew I looked fine. With that brave, newborn security of a beautiful woman having come through a very hard time and being very glad to be alive. When I walked into the doctor's office, I was really quite pleased with myself, all things considered. I was pleased with the way I felt, with my own flair, and my own style. The doctor's nurse, a charmingly bright and steady woman of about my own age, who had always given me a feeling of quiet, no-nonsense support on my other visits, called me into the examining room, and on the way, she asked me how I was feeling. "Pretty good," I said, half expecting her to make some comment about how I looked. "You're not wearing a prosthesis," she said, a little anxiously and not at all like a question. "No," I said, thrown off guard for a minute, "it doesn't feel right." Usually supportive and understanding, the nurse now looked at me urgently and disapprovingly as she told me that even if it didn't look right, it was, quote, "better than nothing," unquote, and that as soon as my stitches were out, I could be fitted for a real form. "You'll feel so much better with it on," she said. "And besides, we really like you to wear something, at least when you come in. Otherwise, it's bad for the morale of the office." I'm glad you appreciate that. I was too outraged to speak, but this was to be only the first such assault on my right to claim and to define my own body. We were in the offices of one of the top breast cancer surgeons in New York City. Every woman there either had a breast removed, might have to have a breast removed, or was afraid of having to have a breast removed. And every woman there could have used a reminder that having one breast did not mean our lives were over, nor that she was less a woman, nor that she was condemned to the use of a placebo in order to feel good about herself and the way she looked. Yet a woman who has one breast and refuses to hide that fact under a puff of lamb's wool, a woman who attempts to come to terms with her changed landscape and changed timetable of life, with her own body and pain and beauty and strength, that woman is seen as a threat to the morale of a breast surgeon's office. Yet I ask you to think. When Moshe Dayan, the former Prime Minister of Israel, stands up in front of Parliament or on TV with an eye patch over his empty eye socket, nobody tells him to go get a glass eye, or that he is bad for the morale of his troops. The world sees him as a warrior with an honorable wound and a loss of a piece of himself which he has marked and mourned and moved beyond. And if you have trouble dealing with Moshe Dayan's empty eye socket, everybody recognizes that it is your problem to solve, not his. Well, women with breast cancer are warriors also. I have been to war, so have you, and I still am. So has every woman who has had one or both breasts amputated because of the cancer which is becoming the primary physical scourge of our time. For me, my scars are an honorable reminder that I may be a casualty in the cosmic war against radiation, animal fat, air pollution, McDonald's hamburgers and red dye number 2, nuclear power, and so forth, but the fight is still going on, and I am still a part of it. I refuse to have my scars hidden or trivialized behind lamb's wool or silicone gel. I refuse to be reduced in my own eyes or in the eyes of others from warrior to mere victim, simply because it would render me a fraction more acceptable or less dangerous to the still complacent. Those who believe that if you cover up a problem, it ceases to exist. I refuse to hide my body simply because it makes a woman-phobic world more comfortable. As I sat in my doctor's office trying to order my perceptions, I realized that the attitude towards prosthesis after breast cancer is an index of this society's attitudes towards women in general as decoration and externally defined sex object. Prosthesis offers the empty comfort of, quote, nobody will know the difference, unquote. But it is this very difference which I wish to affirm, because I have lived it and survived it and wish to share that strength with other women. If we are to translate the silence surrounding breast cancer into language and action against this scourge, then the first step is that women with mastectomies must become visible to each other. For silence and invisibility go hand in hand with powerlessness. And by accepting the mask of prosthesis, women proclaim ourselves as insufficient or dependent upon pretense. Surrounded by other women, all of whom appear to have two breasts, it is sometimes difficult to remember that I am not alone. Yet once I face death as a life process, what is there possibly left for me to fear? Who can ever really have power over me again? Right after surgery, I had a sense that I would never be able to bear missing that great well of pleasure that I connected with my right breast. That sense has completely passed away, as I have come to realize that the well of feeling is within me. I can never lose that feeling because I own it, because it comes out of myself. I can attach it anywhere I want to, because my feelings are a part of me, my sorrow and my joy. I would never have chosen this path, but I am very glad to be who I am here. There is a piece that I would like to share. There is some information that I would like to share with all of you here, which is a part of this essay. Any information about the prevention or treatment of breast cancer which might possibly threaten the vested interests of the American medical establishment is very difficult to acquire in this country. Only through continuing scrutiny of various non-mainstream sources of information, such as alternative and women's presses, can a picture of new possibilities for prevention and treatment of breast cancer emerge. Much of this secrecy is engineered by the American Cancer Society, which has become the loudest voice of the cancer establishment. The American Cancer Society is the largest philanthropic institution in the United States and the world's largest non-religious charity. At the National Information Bureau, which is a charity watchdog organization, lists the ACS among the groups which do not meet its standards. During the past decade, the American Cancer Society collected over $1 billion from the American public. In 1977, it had a $176 million fund balance. Yet less than 15% of its budget is spent on assisting cancer patients. Any holistic approach to the problem of cancer is viewed by the American Cancer Society with suspicion and alarm. As a body, it has consistently focused upon treatment rather than upon prevention of cancer, and then only upon those treatments sanctioned by the most conservative branch of Western medicine. And I ask you to remember here that there is no profit in the prevention of cancer. There is only profit in the treatment of cancer, and there is a great deal of profit in the treatment.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. 10 years after the tragedy of 9/11, Pacifica Radio will present a national broadcast featuring special programming from each Pacifica radio station and the archives that examines its impact on American society. We invite you, the listener, to be part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Hour by including your voice along with those of Stephen Rohde, Howard Zinn, Maxine Waters, June Jordan, Bertrand Russell, Jermaine Greer, and many others. Tell us about how you heard about the attack, what you did, how you feel 10 years later, or perhaps you heard something on Pacifica Radio that was extraordinary. The subject is wide open. Call us at 1-800-735-0230. We want to hear how 9/11 changed your life or your worldview. These will be part of the commemoration broadcast on September 11, 2011. The message number again is 1-800-735-0230. And that does it for this week's From the Vault. If you would like to join our campus campaign sponsoring school libraries across the country with programs like this, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us toll-free at 1-800-735-0230. Special thanks to George Blood Audio in Philadelphia for the personal challenge grant to digitize this recording. I had to promise to quit smoking cigarettes to get 100 tapes of my choosing to be digitized. I kept my promise, and now we can hear this rare Audre Lorde recording. Thanks, George, and my mother thanks you too. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening and keeping our poetry alive.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy viernes 5 de octubre del 2021. Se han recuperado y sobrevivido al COVID-19 más de 225.965.000 personas en todo el mundo. En Estados Unidos, más de 37.194.000. En Brasil, más de 21.047.000. En Argentina, más de 5.160.000. En Colombia,